college back in the late 1800s. Has a very good engineering school, and I graduated with both a bachelor and master's degree in civil engineering from there. My career is now approaching 20 years. 17 and a half of that with Black & Veatch, which is a company headquartered out of Kansas City. Spent 2 years at Bookman Edmondson. They eventually got bought by GEI, and one of the panelists is Ron Ide, and he's worked for Bookman Edmondson. I'll let him tell you, it's been a number of years. You see here in the audience today. In fact, Monday will be my year anniversary at the county. I came here to be their non-governmental project manager, and as an extra benefit, they get somebody that's worked around groundwater banking a little bit. Ron and his company is much more of an expert than I am, but I did a groundwater banking study for the Mojave Water Agency, which was in conjunction with Metropolitan Water District. I came to California in 1984, 6 months after the Northridge earthquake, thank goodness. I now reside in the Tascadero, the Greyhounds. Basic success factors. The first one is probably the most key of all of these. All successful groundwater banking projects have built a level of trust amongst the community, the owners, and the partners. And this is certainly true for this project. We hope that we can, as a team, as a group, as a community, build a trust factor amongst all of ourselves. One way to do that is through public involvement and education, like forums like this. The program needs to be beneficial to the local community, the district, and the banking partners. Here I want to point out this one word here, pre-delivered water. A banking project never begins until water has been deposited. Can't have a monetary bank unless you have money in the bank or gold in the vault or whatever. Another important success factor is to maintain flexibility of the feature. Courtney had a good flow chart. I'm not that technical in graphic creation, so I only had steps, but these are the same steps that Courtney had. I really like her graphic much better. I should have put it in here. What I'm going to do today, though, is I'm going to focus on step number two, which is to discuss some of the physical systems of a groundwater banking project. And the reason I want to do that is I asked Pablo if maybe would it be a benefit to this audience if I did this, because at the first meeting I kind of sensed some of the questions were around some of the facilities, what are involved in the facilities. So I do want to spend some time on that. The other major steps are data collection and hydrogeology studies. There has been some hydrogeology work already done. And then institutional and financial phases. I sent some questions in the first meeting as well that dealt with step three, that I believe probably we'll have another forum meeting sometime that will talk about that. Quickly, the elements. You have to have a supply of water exterior from the area to be brought in. In this case, it's a state water project supply. You build conveyances, pipes, canals, and then you begin the recharge, or the putting the water in the ground, putting it into the bank. And then that increases the storage over time. And then during dry years, when it's time to recover it, you pull it out of the ground, you take it out of the ground, and you return it to the partners or the entity that banked it. And this process can then circulate back and forth around this little horseshoe shape. The methods of banking I'm going to talk about today are these three: in-lieu recharge, direct recharge, and injection wells. But first, let's talk, just remind ourselves of what the hydrologic cycle is all about. Precip from the sky falls on the ground. It enters the groundwater system through percolation, natural recharge. It may be known as forebays up in the foothills of mountains and things of that nature. Wells can withdraw the water and can be placed on crops to irrigate them. It could also be sent to communities. I don't show communities on here because predominantly this is an ag area that we're talking about here. Frankly, the Mojave water study I did, the crops were people. So I had a different shape picture at that time. And then I show corn. I grew a lot of corn in the part of the squiggle of Kansas that I'm from. You have transpiration off of that. You have evaporation off the ground. Those are some of the losses. So here you can see the input to the system and the output from the system. The system basically is a groundwater basin. That's what we're really referring to. Modes of banking. Compare between monetary banking and groundwater banking. On the monetary banking side, this is the side I figure everybody here probably has a good sense of from the day that they first opened a savings account. You deposited money by putting it into the bank. You put your money into the bank. And I'm highlighting these in quotes for a reason. Withdrawal, you take money out of the bank. And then there's bank fees, that ratable fee, where you, it's the difference between what you put in and what you take in. Now, what I left out of this equation is interest. Water can't very much manufacture itself, so we don't really talk about interest too much. But the nomenclature, put and take, when you put water into something, you put it, you'll hear that used a lot as a shorthand for depositing water into the bank. And take is when you recover it out of the groundwater bank. And so the same, deposits, you put the water in, withdrawal, you take the water out. Losses are the difference between put and take. Subtle differences between them on monetary, if it's your money that goes in, then it's your money that comes out, less the fees. OPM, other people's money. If it's other people's money that goes in, then it's other people's money that comes out, less the fees, unless you have a grandmother or grandfather really likes you and lets you keep it. Groundwater banking. If it's your water that goes in, then it's your water that comes out. And you get to keep the losses as well. If it's other people's water, then it's other people's water that comes out, but you also get to keep their losses too. This is a very key element to remember. All right, the three methods. I'm going to get into in-lieu recharge. In-lieu is used because surface water supplies are delivered to the growing area, and it's used for the irrigation water in lieu of turning on pumps and pumping it out of the ground. The amount of water that is banked is equal to the imported supply that is brought and irrigated, okay? And the recharge sources are both natural and from the water that also percolates through the irrigation process, just the hydrologic cycle as a whole. And going back to that hydrologic cycle, we now have introduced a imported supply of water. So when we're putting water into the bank, this is on, and that's used for irrigation, and the irrigation wells are shut off. All the other factors remain the same, even though I don't have all of them shown up here. Evaporation, transpiration, I'll have shown. And then the banking partners, if there are partners, their system shut off when we're in the put mode. When we're in the take mode, the banking partners are receiving water back. The imported supplies are generally shut off, unless you have plumbed it up so that you can both put and take at the same time. And then the irrigation wells are turned back on. Now, if there was a municipality out here, if there was a city withdrawing from the same groundwater bank, and their wells would be on all the time. You can't really shut them off and make them go thirsty during the put process. But I didn't show that on this example. And here's an example of a real-life in-lieu recharge system that exists not far from here, not very far to that, exactly. Summit Tropical Water Storage District, just over here in Kern County. It's in the Shafter-Wasco area. They presently have 1 million acre-feet of storage capacity right now with 7 banking partners. They're building, currently under construction, the ability to bank another 650,000 acre-feet. Water comes from the State Water Project and is used to supply irrigation water to the growers. And the same growers' wells have been replumbed so that when it comes time to deliver the water back to the banking partners, the whole system can run in reverse. They actually have canals that run backwards. It's a very well-engineered, well-maintained system. This is an actual photograph of a pressurized distribution system where the imported water comes in through this canal. It's pressurized and set out into a distribution system through the fields to irrigate the crops. Direct recharge is where you take water from an imported source. You place it generally in percolation ponds for groundwater percolation. It can also be done by discharging it into natural streams if you have the ability and the percolation ability for the water to enter that way, so it doesn't always have to be ponds. And the recharge sources are the natural sources and the water from the irrigation and the imported supply. And here's, you're really taking the imported supply and putting that through percolation into the groundwater system. So here's the hydrologic cycle again with the put mode. We're bringing water in, we're generally placing it in spreading ponds, sometimes it could be in streams for groundwater recharge through percolation. The return water is shut off and the crops are still being irrigated by the existing system. On the take mode, the crops again are still being irrigated by their system. The imported supplies are shut off and wells are brought usually online to return the water to the banking partners. Now, let me stop and say one. There's another way to return water through entitlement exchange that I'll answer that question later exactly what that means. I do not show that up here, but I can explain that one a little bit later. So if that's a buzzword you heard before, I can also go through that. Here's another real-life example of where they have direct recharge in place over in Kern County, again, Arvin Edison Water Storage District. They presently can store some 250,000 acre feet of water for Metropolitan Water District. The water comes in, and Ron, you'll have to correct me on this. This part I was really a little. I think the water works its way through the Cross Valley Canal, and it's state water that gets into the system, and then it returns to the pipeline system. If I'm wrong on this, I apologize, but I think I'm close to being right. I know the photograph is correct. That's the spreading one of the sets of spreading grounds over in Arvin Edison. Injection wells, another buzzword for those is aquifer storage recovery. And a friend of mine would kill me if he heard me say that, because he dislikes that terminology, but it is widely used, and so I'm going to use it as well. Otherwise known as ASR wells. Groundwater basin is recharged by first treating the water to a potable water level, then injecting it into the ground. It's then brought back out and reintroduced into the local potable water distribution system within the area. Again, the hydrology graph shows the water coming in from a potable supply. It actually goes through a treated water process. It's put into the wells and allowed to flow right into the groundwater system. And on the take mode, it's reversed. The water is pumped out and sent back to the banking partners. An example of that exists not far from here, too, over in Ventura County, the Las Poses Basin. Presently has a storage volume of 300,000 acre feet. It stores water for both Cayugas Municipal Water District and Metropolitan Water District. The water comes from the Jensen Water Treatment Plant, which is an MWD owned water treatment plant. And then just a graphical representation on what banking does to water levels, because what I find to be one of the most beneficial factors of a groundwater banking program is its ability to either cease the decline of a groundwater level system that might be stressed and flatten that out some. And so here's what we're trying to show here is what the water level decline might be looking like. These are all make-believe. I'll show you a real life one here in a moment. If the groundwater levels are heading down because they're stressed heavily by a lot of pumping, and then if you introduce an imported water supply to offset some of this pumping, you can see the actual groundwater levels not fall as rapidly. Sometimes you can even see them rebound in the opposite direction. And then during the withdrawal mode, of course, then the water levels begin to draw down again. But at the end of the program, these losses that I mentioned to you earlier, they retain within the groundwater basin itself. And so that's why these two lines don't, this does not come back and touch onto this line. It stays shifted off, and this is time, so you're delaying the effects of the over, and I'm not saying that this basin is over pumped, but if you do over pump in a particular area, that's what you can get. Here's a real life situation where over in Semitropics area, they were declining water level, and they projected if they would have stayed on that course, this is what they would have looked like. By the year 2030, it would have been almost 550 feet to water. But when the State Water Project came through, they were able to build the infrastructure to supply surface water to meet irrigation needs, and they saw the groundwater level start to go up. And then when the drought of the 80s and 90s came, they started heading back down again. And at this point in time is when the groundwater banking program was put into place for the first 1 million acre feet. And so the purple shade here is showing the amount of water that's been banked in the ground by the banking partners, and the green, of course, shows where the water level would be today if the banking system was not operating.
So the green is in lieu.
All this water here at this level has been offset by the importing of water from the State Water Project. And so this is a huge success factor. And I'm sure the other irrigation districts within the Central Valley, they probably show similar graphs. But this graph I know very well. Effects of banking on the decline of groundwater. The basic effect is the benefit is that you can either defer or actually reverse the falling groundwater levels. And what that means is less energy to pump because you don't have it to lift it near as high. And with the rising cost of electrical energy, it's a good saver if you can do that. At this point, I'll stop. If you have any quick questions, I think you may want to move on.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. Yeah, basically now is the time for the good discussion questions. Just basically to sum up what John was saying, you know, those are some of the methods that will be looked at in this feasibility study that we have the grant money for in relation to our specific areas and the way our basin works and, you know, all the impacts that might happen with those different methods, looking at the feasibility of, you know, those different methods.
Yeah, so if you did that in our basin, and it's in essence a reliability recharge for Santa Barbara County. Is that going to be looked at as San Luis Obispo County using their allotment?
It would be a joint, looking at it in a joint fashion, because we have.
Well, I understand that. That's the looking. No, I'm saying, at the end of the day. Yeah,
the end
year,
result.
Well, no, the year 2035. If that's all we've done in the county of San Luis Obispo, is. You know, the state guys are going to say, well, yeah, great, you're banking Santa Barbara water, but you haven't used any, so we're taking your allotment down to 5,000.
I think we'd be allocated.
Well, the idea is one of our principal, maybe Ron, good time to come up too, and because we're imagining that the questions are going to be a variety, so we're all going to kind of, depending on what it is, all come up.
Ron, did you bring the brochures on the semi-tropic?
Yes, actually.
You might have saw some brochures in the back in the Las Poses Basin. This is the brochure the Semi-Tropic Water Storage District has put together that kind of briefly summarizes their in-lieu system. And I encourage you to pick some of these up. I'm just going to send them back on the table.
Paul Sorsen here is from FUGRO. He did the basin study for the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin. And then this is Ron Ide. Bookman Edmondson, a lot of experience with the groundwater banking programs. And then Pablo Ogren from Public Works. And John will be able to answer a lot of the questions.
So the first question, which was, Courtney explained that one of the principal issues here is the need to put our state water access entitlement to beneficial use. And so the question is, at the end of the day, in 2035, who will the state recognize as being the entity that put the water to beneficial use if we develop something in cooperation with Santa Barbara County? That's still, you know, an if statement. But it's certainly our intent, we've expressed it to CCWA, our meeting with DWR up on Friday, that if we do anything with Santa Barbara County, then those agreements that have to be executed will specifically state that the program is San Luis Obispo County putting its water to beneficial use. That's going to be spelled out in black and white. It's also what we've said to CCWA is that the banking program itself, our starting point is that we want them to help pay for the infrastructure. We certainly see the need where they have a reliability issue right now, and on state water we don't have a reliability issue right now. But the term of the agreement would expire around 2035, maybe the year before, so that at the expiration of that term, then all that infrastructure is our infrastructure, that our reliability that we've sold to them over the last 20, 25 years or whatever, is that's the end of the program with them. So that's our starting point, is that we want to partner with them. We certainly want to be able to sell them reliability. Whether or not there's going to be enough financial incentive for them to agree to a program that will expire before 2035, you know, that's going to be one of the results of the feasibility study is, you know, is it feasible? How much is it going to cost? Can we be competitive with Santa Barbara County? And again, there's an if statement there because certainly we might have local interests who would want to partner in on a potential groundwater banking program.
Eric?
Yeah. John showed a scenario where even though you essentially the parties who were essentially using the groundwater basin and its off-stream storage recovered all of their water, the put and the take phase balanced, as I understand it, but nonetheless there was a residual amount in the groundwater basin that would not have been there if it were not for this transaction. Let's say this groundwater basin has overlying property owners who have wells. this takes place and this effect exists, whose water is the difference in terms of ownership or legal recognition?
It's the property owner of the groundwater basin itself.
And
in other words, the people that lay over top of it.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense,
they're going to be. That's the losses. They become the benefactor of that. The losses become, you know, if they wanted to, in theory, if you could put in more wells to irrigate more crops, you could benefit that way. Or you could just, more importantly, you realize the benefit through a higher groundwater level, reduced pumping lift, reduced energy cost, reduced money that goes to PG&E.
Along that line, I have a question for Ron, I guess, and that is, in your experience, has there been a general loss percentage that's applicable in groundwater banking, or is it case-by-case analysis, or?
Well, my experience is primarily in Kern County with some of the projects that John kind of briefed you on, and there's been a, I guess if you will, kind of a rule of thumb which has been used more than once of about 10%. Typically what's been done is contractually it's been agreed to that there would be a loss factor of 10% applied unless subsequent study indicated that it should be something different. So at the outset, without, you know, it was a contractually agreed to rather than a scientifically determined number.
And with respect to the ASR systems, there's a practical limit to the take as well. Just technically, you can't always extract as much water out of the ASR wells as you put in, and so there's just a practical technical loss as well that's variable from well to well, actually, system to system. So there's not really a rule of thumb there, but there are some losses that remain in the aquifer system.
I think Bill had a question.
Yeah, in the 50s, late 50s, and through the 70s, the Agricultural Research Service did a lot of work on the physical phenomena of getting water back underground in the valley, starting in Bakersfield with actually selection of a lot of recharge sites that are over there now, and then eventually we ended up in Fresno and worked with the irrigation districts for the grant from the Department of Water Resources. And how would you say the rounding experience in this from a scientific standpoint was that we had to produce a report at the end of the period. And at that time, Helen Peters was the groundwater specialist for the Department of Water Resources. And it was my job to put together the final report, which I have a copy of here. Contains all the things that we've been discussing here so far. And she came back and she says, well, you haven't covered the institutional issues associated with this this issue of groundwater recharge. And I said to her, institutional issues, what are those? And in the last meeting, I think it was an excellent example of what we're talking about here. We had better solve the institutional issues to start out with in terms of siting. You can go to soils maps, you can do all the geophysics you want, and unless you can come up with the institutional solution of the institutional issues associated with where you want a groundwater bank while you're in serious problems. And the thing with the valley was, you had institutions doing essentially groundwater banking. The only thing, they weren't augmenting their banking with structures. And this is how the recharge facilities were eventually developed in the Bakersfield area, and then up through the valley associated with the irrigation districts, which were the institutions that were doing the water balance budgeting for their operations. And so I do think the first step in this thing is to get people together to, how would you say, format an applicable institutional approach to the problem, and then deal with the technical issues. I think the technical issues are fairly simple compared to trying to find a situation where the legal issues match the geology in order to accomplish the banking program. And our eventual project was with the city of Fresno, and it was the Leaky Acres project. And they walked in, the city walked in the door and said, "What can we do with the water that the Fresno Irrigation District is dumping into the San Joaquin River, and we're paying for it?" And so we generated the site, and if anybody's interested in these things, I've got forwarded selected reprints from the laboratory to the Public Works Department on these things. But in each case, there was an institution there to take on the project. Now we're going to have to create the institution in order to accomplish this, and that's not an easy thing to do. Now that the family's in politics.
Well, certainly, as you know, as the flood control district governed by the Board of Supervisors is our regional water institution, but just like Kern County, you know, our flood control district is analogous to the Kern County Water Agency in terms of it's the regional water contractor for state water. But within Kern County, like Semitropic, there are individual institutions that actually implement programs. That does not exist in our county. You know, we don't have a, you know, Paso Robles Basin Irrigation District, if you would. Part of these, you know, efforts to reach out is that if the agricultural interest in the Paso Basin is interested in creating an irrigation district and taking the lead on these type of efforts, then certainly, I mean, to us, that would be awesome, because it would be building, you know, that local institution and the local constituency to really help promote, you know, the water supply benefits. So right now all we have is the regional entity that is like the Kern County Water Agency. Not exactly, you know, not all the details and are the same, but in substance it's the same type of an entity. That's what Central Coast Water Authority is down in Santa Barbara County. So it's just the regional entities, and certainly you know, again, if the effort of establishing a local institution like an irrigation district is something that everybody wants to consider, we would certainly help in doing that. You know, there's steps in government formation processes. I believe that like irrigation districts, you know, levee maintenance districts might require special legislation, but in this type of a situation where all of these efforts are very consistent with the California Water Master Plan, the draft California Water Master Plan, it's easy to envision getting support for the development of an irrigation district through the state of California as well.
Maybe just follow up on Pavel's comments there just a little bit, and comments were made here a minute ago. The fact that you don't have perhaps the area all carved up into individual irrigation districts or water agencies, while on the one hand you might look at it as a downside, I would offer that perhaps it's a two-edged sword, and that there's also an upside to that, because, you know, again, it's the if that Pablo's mentioned, you're able to come together as a region for a common purpose, then you're not having to necessarily, you know, deal with these institutional boundaries that exist, say in Kern County, that have no relation to hydrologic boundaries. What one district does, another, you know, plus or minus the next guy field. It's the proverbial balloon. You pinch it here, and something else happens over here. And so I see that maybe a good thing and a bad thing both.
One thing we forgot to do in the beginning was introduction. So if you wouldn't mind with your question introducing yourself, I think that would be really great. In the back there.
My name is Doug. I live here locally. I just had a question. Ideally, how far downstream would you be looking at injection sites?
I think that's part of the study.
Well, Paul, you can address how close the about the boundaries of the basin in relationship to where we're at right now.
Yeah, the Paso Robles groundwater basin, the eastern boundary is out here, just in rough terms, out more or less by the Shandon rest stop, you know, in that area. There is the Chelan Basin on this side, but it's poor quality and has a totally different hydrologic regime than the Paso Basin. Basically, from you know this side of Shandon westward, and then down into the San Juan Creek and Shed Creek, Shell Creek, Comati Creek or Comati Canyon area. You know the basin extends down that direction as well. There's the challenge on the technical side, on the recharge side, the challenge for this project would be clearly to find areas that would accept the water, not only be able to economically put the water in the ground, but then know it's going to be there when it comes back, when you want to take it back out. The right in the area of Shandon, and if any of you have your wells right in Shandon and I misspeak, then let me know. But for the most part, right in the Shandon area, water levels are relatively high. The farther west we go, water levels start dropping. The pressures are the demand is greater. The pressure on the aquifer and the stress on the aquifer is greater to the west. You know, by the time we get out to Estrella area and east of Paso Robles, water levels are 250 or more feet below ground surface, and storage available storage goes up considerably. But then that's a long ways to go. I mean, pipeline costs are pretty expensive to take it that far. And that's a roundabout way of telling you, we don't know how far, you know, we'd have to go to find suitable sites. Would the San Juan, south of Shandon towards San Juan, would that be a better area? It very well may be. The hydrology, the hydrogeology, the stratigraphy down there perhaps is more suitable than immediately in the Shandon area. That would just be part of this overall feasibility study, is to start looking at those areas in particular. The other thing with the Shandon area is it's the only part of the basin really that has almost a multi-layer or two-layer aquifer system. As some of you very well may know, there's historically there's been artesian wells there along the Estrella River. Those wells, for the most part, are coming from 300 or 400 feet depth wells that are into a semi-confined aquifer at that depth. And so clearly, spreading basins on top of those is not going to recharge that aquifer. But finding the forebay areas or the recharge port areas for those aquifers would be part of the challenge as well. And where those are, we know where the forebay areas are, but how far we would have to go to put this volume of water into the aquifer is another issue. That's a good way of saying we'll find out, maybe.
Let's in the early 50s, there was a lot of groundwaters around here. And they went through our ranch a couple of times. I talked to the guys, and they say there is a dike down by Whitley Gardens in the Shannon area that blows the water from going. That's that, more or less. So there is a hole in the Shannon area.
Yeah, the stratigraphy does slowly change. I mean, it does. Now, you know, I guess I would dispute whether there's actually a barrier or a dike, so to speak, in that area. I mean, I think we know now from the hundreds of wells that have been drilled over the last 50 years through there, and the records that we've looked at, that the stratigraphy is pretty continuous. The systems, you know, this two-layer system out in Shandon does eventually die out and merge into a single system in the Whitley Gardens Estrella area. You know, we lose the confined nature, we lose the artesian wells, and water quality becomes more more constant water quality out that direction. So, you know, to be honest, I don't know specifically of which you speak there, but I, you know, I'd be interested to see, you know, talk to some of those folks and see if they have any records of that, because it's certainly nothing that we've seen with the hundreds of wells that we've looked at.
Another thing, the Salinas River is an upside down river. And if you don't believe the amount of water that flows through it, watch the National Piano when they open the gates and the water runs out there, it just disappears.
Oh yeah, the underflow capacity of the Salinas River is tremendous. Mm-hmm. It's huge. We have that in all of these systems here, the Estrella, you know. Steve and I were just talking on the tour. You know, you see, even with all the water, the rainfall this year, say San Juan Creek is still running, but Shell Creek coming out of Comanche Canyon is already dry at the surface, right? Well, that water didn't just disappear. I mean, it's disappeared from the surface, but it's still in the underflow because it's such a sandy, you know, it just percolates into the underflow, and these rivers are great. There's huge storage capability in some of these rivers, the Salinas particularly. That's a long ways to go with this water.
Wouldn't it be better to go south, right to the San Juan from here, rather than go down to Shannon?
With this excess water,
yeah.
Maybe.
The pipeline route right through the Templars.
Why bank it on this side of the mountain? Why not bank it on the valley side?
East of here?
East of here.
Now, do you know? I mean, yeah. I mean, we've talked about that. That's come up before.
Yeah, those certainly that's an option. But those losses that you could reap by having them under your own land then become the benefit of those folks in the Central Valley. I mean, I'll tell you right now, Will Boschman would be happy as a lark to be able to have you join his new stored water recovery unit. But I don't know. As part of the study, that's an option. I think they'll take the DWR grant money and investigate it further. We might be fortunate enough to find a good place for it here at home.
There's some, I think I'm correct in saying that there's some water quality issues east of here that would make that more difficult, though, too, than heading into the Paso Basin. But, you know.
ID4 doesn't think so, do they?
ID4?
I'll ask Ron that question.
they don't think, could you?
They don't, ID4 doesn't believe that the water quality issues east of here are insurmountable.
East of what dimension?
Not sure what you're.
East of the coastal, west of the coastal range, west of the Sierras. ID4 using it for domestic use in the city of Bakersfield.
Correct.
They're a huge participant in groundwater basin banking, aren't they?
They
don't find the water treatment, the water quality issues there insurmountable. I don't think MET? I don't think they find the water quality is. I think we've heard testimony they're participating in almost every water bank they can participate in in the Central Valley.
And one of the things, just as a, I guess, a footnote to that is, and I don't know when the dust will settle, but it's been up in the air a long time as to just exactly what the rules are, and guidelines, and standards for putting water into the aqueduct. So to some extent, that's a bit of a moving target, and depending on where all of that falls out, I mean, it may dictate, you know, that those projects or someone, participants in those projects may end up having to treat at some point in time.
But aren't they based a lot of on lieu, in lieu?
Well, I'm talking about the return.
Well, in return, using in lieu aqueduct water rather than returning.
Well, there's two means, and John kind of alluded to them. One is the direct return, which is pumping into the aqueduct, and the other means is indirectly, which I guess you're referring to, which would be like an entitlement exchange, whereby, for example, ID4 with State Water Project water in the aqueduct would leave that in the aqueduct, say, for someone else to divert, and that's the return, where they rely or fall back on pumping or some other source. Now, the thing to keep in mind is, and this was certainly the case when Semitropic was developing its banking program, beginning in the late 80s with studies. It was initially conceived of as being with the return or to the banking partner being totally dependent on entitlement exchange, i.e. an indirect return of water. There was no connection for pumping water into the aqueduct. Well, as chance would have it, while those studies were ongoing and demonstration projects were ongoing, we had the early 90s come along and ag got a zero entitlement, something that was thought to be unthinkable, or was unthinkable and thought that would never happen. Well, that was a real wake-up call to someone like Metropolitan, who saw the writing on the wall that in the year or years when they might want it the most and need it the most, they wouldn't be able to get the water back. And so it was because of that that in the ultimate formulation and implementation of that project, there was a direct return facility and component to guarantee a minimum return. It also still relies and includes the indirect return by release of entitlement, but, and that's whatever it is, whatever the allocation is in that particular year, but there's a guaranteed component, which is physically pumping water, groundwater, back into the aqueduct.
Yeah, but that's in part because I believe the Monterey Agreement changed where ag would never suffer the zero, not entitlement, the zero allocation again, because the 3 out of 5 was changed, I believe.
Right, that was changed, but it didn't change Metropolitan's...
Didn't change Met's situation, yes.
...view that they needed a guaranteed return.
Right.
Even though ag might never get a zero allocation, it was clear that they would either get little or maybe be severely constrained in the return in the years when they wanted it most, and that wasn't acceptable.
Another question up front here.
Oh, thank you. Since you've invited the public on, this question is probably beyond simple-minded, but one clarification The idea here is to bank some water, some entitlement for Santa Barbara?
I'd say what it is it's more of this, is that out of their state water allocation, the state water project itself on an average annual basis can only deliver about 75% of what the allocations are. So in wet years like this year, Santa Barbara County is going to get, you know, the water that, you know, essentially that they're going to, that they need and they're looking for. In these wet years, we could take our excess allocation and put it into a bank. And then in dry years, we would be able to access that water for their needs, you know, as well as ours. Let me back up. Some of our agencies, like Morro Bay, in order to firm up their own needs in a drought period, they've purchased some of our excess entitlement just on paper. And so they've kind of dealt with it through what we call a drought buffer agreement. Santa Barbara County doesn't have enough water to be able to do that. So again, in dry years, the idea is we would pull out our water out of our basin and we would deliver it to them to help meet their shortages. But this would all be done through long-term contracts and financial guarantees so that we know that we have a predictable amount of revenue in order to pay for the infrastructure. But essentially, we would still be banking our water, and then we would be providing them with water in terms of during the droughts when they have big needs. And the big question is it feasible, both from a technical standpoint and then financially speaking, do the numbers work out that, you know, they would even want to do a deal with us, or would they rather just work with Semi-Tropic and do something with them?
So at the last meeting, you were talking about the cost of a pipeline being $3 million a mile. And there's already this pipeline here can pump 43 MGDs and the average is only 25. Why isn't the banking happening on the pipeline, or why isn't it happening in the Santa Maria Basin, which is owned by both of us? Why are we banking it in the Paso Robles Basin?
Couple
or
even
a reservoir that we have along the way. Reservoirs we already have that are on.
One is the idea of potentially doing some banking down in the Santa Maria groundwater basin. That exists. I mean, that potential does exist. But the key is that when we get to Colonial Pass right here, and on this map, we're right here. The capacity in the aqueduct up to here is significantly more. It can provide. All of the water that is the potable, treatable water, plus it can deliver all of our excess entitlement. And in fact, we think it probably can even maybe deliver Santa Barbara County excess entitlement, although they don't really have it anymore because they sold it back to the state, but maybe they want to buy it back. Anyways, the pipeline here is much, much bigger, but south, you know, after the treatment plant itself, it gets constricted really quickly, only for it was designed for the supplies that everybody said that they wanted to buy back in the early 1990s, San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County. Now, it happens to be that the difference between design and reality exists, so there is some available capacity in the pipeline down here, but again, it's small in comparison to our ability to get all that extra water in wet years up to here. And so there is some potential to do some groundwater banking down in the Santa Maria groundwater basin. But the reality is that we just can't push as much water south during that period of time. Now, it also sort of brings in the question of the difference between how much capacity do we have in the wet season when the potal delivery demands are lower, as our tour guide was speaking of, you know, the difference between winter and summer. We know on a 7 days a week, basically 52 weeks out of the year, we've got the capacity to this facility right here, and then it shrinks down. We don't have nearly.
They also have a different kind of water.
Pardon me?
They also have a different kind of water.
Yeah. Okay, so then if we wanted to use this pipe, this is all treated. So in order to bank any water past this point in here, every drop would have the cost of treatment through this treatment facility. This treatment facility ultimately would still need to be expanded. And then in order to do the banking, you have to detreat it, or
You're still sending treated water. It's still goes through this plant.
At this. Now, the groundwater banking in Paschal, no. If there's a separate pipeline that's built from here, you know, down to somewhere, let's just say Shannon vicinity, that would be a raw water pipeline. It would not go through the treatment plant. And it might, there might have to be some stuff done with that water supply, so that it could, like if you're going to do a, well, the injection wells themselves have the highest treatment requirements.
Yeah, it would have to go through the treatment plant if you do the injection.
Yeah. So, or have some other sort of treatment downstream.
Apparently you need clam removal.
Yeah, the clams removed too, yeah.
So, yeah. So
that's why I was asking about the cost of ozonation. But apparently it's pretty prohibitive, and especially as energy costs are going up, because that would be a form of taking the organisms and stuff out of the water from the east side without putting chlorine in.
Alternate disinfection method.
So can you, okay, so you've increased the capacity in the Paschal basin. Then how do you keep track of that? If it's going to be, if you've increased the pet capacity for ag, how do you keep track of that ag retains ownership of that and doesn't get, you know, utilized in greater, you know, population? And then you have your benefit of the, between the put and the take. Can you quantify that so that you know what that extra is? Presumably that's for ag also.
Well, in some respects, you know, a groundwater banking program is going to have a ledger just like the, you know, a financial bank is going to have.
That's purely it. It's, you know, how many acre feet you put into the system, and then when there's a call on it to withdraw, you can't withdraw it all out of the bank. Like, you can probably go to the bank now and take all your money out.
Unless you're Bill Gates.
Unless you're probably Bill Gates or something like that. But on a groundwater banking system, it typically has a return that has to, you know, to get it all out, it would take a number of years, 5 years, let's say. But, so it's an accounting system. You meter how much water comes in and gets spread, and then you subtract off the losses, and that's how much water you can take out.
So, but the Paschal groundwater basin right now doesn't have specific allocations. Have an ag policy that says the land, it goes for ag, but there's no kind, it hasn't been adjudicated, saying.
That's right. Which is the same over in Burn County. That basin's not adjudicated. It's an accounting system of water in, an accounting system of water out.
Yeah, so again, if we put 10,000 acre feet of water into the groundwater basin, and we assume 10% that 1,000 acre feet is just going to accrue to the benefit of the overlying property owners, and therefore we have a right to pull 9,000 acre feet out at, you know, some future date, but we're still going to be restricted by the ability to physically withdraw it. And that is actually a good analogy with banking too, because if we really read the fine print of our banking agreements, they can restrict how much money we can take out of their institution on any, you know, on a given day.
I don't have that much.
But, you know, they only have so much in the vault even, and, you know, they have a limitation on how much they can let somebody pull out at any given time as well.
One of the, you know, you were speaking about the Kern River fan. At one time, DWR was really concerned about the water banking problem in the Ford Cross Valley Canal and all this, because of the fact that there's high radionuclides in the groundwater, the native groundwater. And so there may be this issue associated with MWD relative to delivery of groundwater into the canal. And it would be the same here. Just to what degree the existing groundwater would condition the ability to deliver that water to the pipeline over Santa Barbara. So I'm a great believer in looking at water quality as a major issue in terms of groundwater banking.
Yeah, and that's like on my slide where I said there's three steps. There's some sub-steps that are not mentioned. Water quality, that's a very key one that is looked at. Somebody made the comment about the return and the water quality return. Just real quickly, MWD it's interesting. On the one hand, they sometimes complain about some constituents of the water quality that's returned. In one particular case, arsenic is one that they like to complain about. That's from the Central Valley. But the groundwater banking study I did, which was over on the east branch of the state aqueduct, through Mojave Water Agency's area, they told me I care less what the arsenic level is. So it all depends on how thirsty they are. Frankly, MWD has all the treatment capabilities to take care of any arsenic issue or whatever constituent there is. It's a posturing position that they oftentimes use to push the cost of these banks down. But it's still unproven. And then Ron brings up a very good point. I know that Ray Hart, who's a senior vice president of Bookman Edmiston and former deputy director at DWR, I think he's trying to work the political scene on the establishment of a policy for return of bank water to the state aqueduct system. You're taking groundwater, which is pristine to the point where you can drink it, and put it into a raw water system, yet there's no check, there's no credits and demerits for constituent by constituent. They have to, they just say it can't be any different than the ambient temp or the ambient condition. And I think that policy is too restrictive, especially in the area of water resources, where we need to be more flexible in our ability to utilize the water and the, you know, what we have at hand, and not strangle ourselves by how many parts per million or trillion that may exist, especially when it's treatable. Anyway, get off my soapbox.
I think we have another real challenge here with this project, because related to water quality, because there isn't an overlying agency or district of benefit to deal with in the Shandon, San Juan, Whitley Gardens area. And so the challenge then, of course, is to make sure that individual landowners do not recognize any degradation. Well, I shouldn't say any. I mean, that would have to be defined. But yeah, a degradation of water quality. Because now we're dealing with individuals,
yeah,
rather than a mothership agency.
And there's a certain thing too on water quality that the state water supplies overall have low TDS and generally a good water quality. Well, maybe we could get lucky and have the ability to introduce a relatively good water quality, and then if the extraction areas have lower water quality that we actually pull out, but the pipeline, the banking pipeline, then in those years where we're taking, the flow gets reversed, pumped up to the treatment plant, and then, you know, either blended with what supplies are coming in or run through the treatment plant. Then there's always that outside possibility that we're actually introducing a better water quality into the basin than we're actually pulling out, and pulling out a lower water quality, but that, you know, this treatment facility can deal with it.
Well, I think that's a very real possibility here. I really do.
Yeah, I'm interested in essentially the physical extent of area that we're talking about, because when Paul talked about contracts with individual landowners, I recognize that lawyers are a major expense if you've got a lot of landowners with whom you have to have individual contracts. What kind of acreage of overlying land, if we were going to say be banking somewhere between 15 and 20,000 acre feet for periods of multiple years, you know, looking for that kind of capacity in the Paso Robles groundwater basin, what kind of acreage of overlying rights are we talking about?
Well, it depends on the amount of storage that's available.
Yeah. Depends on available storage. It depends on the ability of the aquifer to take the water. I don't mean to be elusive, but really we don't know that.
So it's one of the things to investigate.
Absolutely.
You don't need to.
Absolutely.
You can't even get within an order of magnitude.
No, I wouldn't.
Well, I'd hate to spit a number out here just off the top of my head. I don't know, Eric. It's not small. I mean, we're not, you know, we're not gonna solve it by flooding the Shandon Park. You know, that's for sure. We're talking sizable acreage, or either that or a sizable network of in lieu participants.
Eric, the idea too of how much sort of storage capacity you need in the basin itself is going to depend on that put and take cycle. How quickly, you know, if you're getting 1 year out of three where you're putting it in, and 2 years out of three that you're taking half of it out in the second year and half of it out in that third year, and you have a relatively quick put and take cycle, then that's going to have a different effect on your need for storage, as opposed to if you have a long put cycle and a long take cycle, then you're going to have more. And that's sort of, again, banking.
Yeah, I was assuming the point was partly to have some banking for extended drought periods, but maybe that isn't it. Yeah, I mean, it could even just be used as seasonal peaking capacity in the system on a yearly basis. But
well, the idea of the put and take cycle, though, is that from the DWR records on the reliability of the program, that's not going to be a very rigorous calculation in order to figure out, but that's part of it. You know, again, if you're running through that cycle every 3 years or every 5 years or every 9 years, that duration is going to have a direct relationship to how much storage you're going to have to be able to be able to have. You know, is it end up being a short-term savings plan or a long-term savings plan in a way?
Using the semi-tropical Los Positos projects to use as a historical basis, you talked about that the overlaying landowners would benefit through that 10% loss unless the recharge of the aquifers. The reverse side of that, does this impose restrictions on their groundwater pumping or any punitive costs should they expand or use more water than they have on a traditional basis?
What was the last part of your, if you could repeat the last part, I didn't understand.
Is there a net cost to that landowner that's imposed on them if they utilize more water than they have traditionally?
Yeah, if the landowner uses more?
Correct. In other words, through an existing well.
Okay. And I'll speak specifically the semi-tropic example. They have developed additional acreage within their district that had been developed in total reliance on pumped groundwater for irrigation. They constructed distribution systems to move surface water to those lands and turn off wells when the water was available. The district, through its banking program, funded the cost of the facilities to move the surface water to those lands when available. The contract with the landowner, between the landowner and the district, is structured in a fashion that that says, one, you'll take the water when it's available, assuming it's at a price competitive with your cost to produce groundwater. And on the flip side, on the recovery side, the district has a right to use that well to recover previously banked water, and it has to have been previously banked. But its right to recover is subject to the landowner's first use for his needs, for his overlying irrigation needs. So the use would be more an off-peak use relative to the irrigation of the ground.
Yeah, let me answer it a little bit different, Doug. If you're not a contractor for that water and you're not doing the exchange thing, your overlying right continues. So you would continue to have the right to extract the water as long as you could show that it would be there. The only time you wouldn't have that right is if the importing agency could show that If it weren't for the imported water, there wouldn't be any water for you. But otherwise, it's your water first. You've got the first take, and basically the imported water is just coming in on top of that. Or I like to say it comes in underneath. You just get the benefit of the top of the flow.
Well, and the quantity is based on beneficial use, which would be that you're growing grapes, like if you produce associated with grape juice. So if you put in alfalfa, why don't you put the alfalfa?
So does that mean that all of the water pumped, all of the pumps pumping from that aquifer would be monitored?
I would never propose that we would ask to monitor the,
well, not
the wells
of
agricultural
anyway.
Interest. No.
You want to keep your job until retirement?
I want to keep my life.
What do they do? What do they do at Sinotropic? Because they do have direct return through those growers' wells.
Right. Well, any district use is going to be metered.
Right. Yeah. That.
See, that's the whole thing that's different, is in semi-tropic, everybody's part of a system. You get into the system and you're taking surface water and you're figuring out, and it's supposed to be a net zero to you, the farmer, but they're using your wells and you're taking their surface water. It's a lot more complicated.
Well, one of the things I joked with Pablo shortly after I came to work here, and I talked about what's your state allocation and what's utilization. I said, boy, the first thing that should happen is this water storage district should be formed to put this, you know, to join all those forces together to utilize this.
Well, no, don't say what I said.
I can't remember what you said exactly. But he was shocked to hear that, I guess. But, you know, maybe through forums like this and more understanding, who knows? Maybe
see, all those districts over there, and I farm for a very large farming company that belongs to most of them, it was based on getting that very, very cheap water, very, very, very cheap water, and farming for umpteen years, and so like he was saying, they're all very used to sharing that water, and well, they go down in arm wrestle. I'm sure you've been to some of those meetings, but
I mean, Ron mentioned the benefit of us not being jurisdictional with boundaries at this point, other than we are under the flood control district, which has jurisdiction, and that some of these arguments across boundary lines don't exist because our boundary line is our county.
Right. Yeah. So for a lot of those historical farmers, the surface water was the whole deal. They didn't have wells. You know, and the guys out in semi-tropic, they were further out, and they took more money, and they did put in wells. You know, and then the guys back in Delano and stuff later added wells. Not everybody, but then none of them would pay what we pay PG&E here.
Yeah. they even say their water's too expensive too. I was up near Orville Dam, and the guy was talk to me about this free water he gets out of the after bay.
Thermalito,
thank you. And I said, wow, you get that for free. I go, well, how far is groundwater down? Oh, 8 feet. I go, well, why don't you pump that? That costs money. And I was doing a groundwater banking study for Mojave Water, and he said, it's 600 feet to water. I'm going, gee, it's all relevant. It's really all relevant.
Yeah.
But that is the real value. You bring up the cost. That's the real value of an in-loop program.
Yeah.
Where basically the district would be delivering water to a grower, and the grower then would not be pumping their own wells.
Well, I mean, all of that is beautiful. So, you know, that extra beautiful clean water filling in my pumping costs go down and down. But in those dry years, and you're starting to take it back down to Santa Barbara, my pump going to start sucking air.
Yeah.
400 feet, and wherever it's at, there, you know, there.
One of these
clearly
success
it can't.
Yeah,
clearly it can't. You know, the program would not work if that were the case.
Yeah.
It just simply would not work.
Why
not? And
water
and
levels can be no harm.
Yeah, what would stop them from keeping? You know, they want the water. They got the pumps. They're taking it. And when it goes down, they're gonna say, "Well, Willie, that isn't because of us. That's because you guys. You know, you added two wells and somebody else planted some grapes. That's you guys using it. We've measured how much water we put in, and we're not taking it all. You know, we're better in the valley. They did 10%. We did. We've made a deal with you, 25%. We're beautiful. We're great. Everything. You know, and on paper it is." But in the meantime, in practicality, in all these high years, all your water went to Castroville and beyond. And, you know, and we recharge every year, and you know where the Forbay is. And I have my suspicions. It's over by Black Mountain, and it recharges, and it goes right under Steve's ranch and comes over to mine. And that recharges every year, and we pump it down. You can see it go up and down seasonally. And you guys come and try to bank on top of it. Yeah, there's times when there's plenty of banking room, but the next cycle, there's only X amount of easy storage space. And so then it goes to litigation, and because either you get mad at, you know, the people that you're, who've hired you down in Santa Barbara are going to get mad at me, or my boss is going to get mad at the folks in Santa Barbara, and the judge in all his wisdom is going to take the big saw or the knife and say, well, cut that basin in half. And, you know, I started off with enough water, you know, outside of, you know, pain to the nose through PG&E and getting worse, but, and at the end of the day, I won't have rights to my water, or my company won't have rights, and Steve won't have rights, and that's, I mean, you know, maybe I'm just really nervous.
Well, I think it's good that you're nervous.
Well, I think so, too.
Yeah, and it might also be that, of course, since you have the land and you know the water situation, you might have better vision than we have as
I think that, you know, like George, who's farmed by Whitley Gardens for over 50 years and has talked to the people, and Smith has drilled a lot of the wells that you saw, the Smith and Smith guys, they all had the feeling that the Shandon deal is a separate deal. Just like how you saw that when you get over here past Chelan and right up to the rest area, there's really crummy water, and it doesn't seem to mix all the way, you know, somewhere there, but by the rest area of the graveyard, there's a line, and it's horrible there, and yet it's the same alluvium going back and forth for 15,000 years from the north and the south.
Well, it even goes down to Joe Russell's house.
Yeah.
The bastard.
Right, for the guys that really know all the nicks and crannies where the horrible water comes down. And, you know, and so there's something similar happening about Whitley Gardens when, in the 60s, when the guys did all the sugar beets, they could really see it drop, and everybody in Whitley Gardens ran out of water. They were farming sugar beets in Shandon, and it didn't drop the same way, and it recharged.
No, oh, you're right there, and there clearly is
there's
a,
something going on. I mean, well, there's I understand it's the same historical alluvium that's all interlayered, but you know, it's pushed, you know, the equivalent of bentonite clay through that alluvium. There's, you know, where it came from and how it's layered in there. You'd have to start, you know, having 1,000-foot wells drilled horizontally, and then you'd think, oh, neat, look at this green yuck in this area, and it goes up and down for quite a ways, this is why. And then you'd believe in it. It's, but until somebody does that, there's not going to be any hard evidence by drilling our wells this way until somebody got right on that area with a well.
Well, no, there actually is quite a bit of evidence, just from interference studies and water level measurements.
Yeah,
you know, the hydrogeology, the hydrostratigraphy between the Estrella versus Shandon versus the Creston, they are different. There's no question about it. But there aren't barriers between the areas. You know, we went into this pastoral's groundwater basin study, and I'll admit.
Well, I don't mean like a big balloon or a big band of bentonite clay, but yeah, you know, the water isn't moving.
Well, it is moving between the areas. It's not moving very quickly.
No.
You know, we went into this basin study, and admittedly, and I'll admit that when I went into it, I had a preconceived notion. I fully anticipated that we would be splitting the Paso Robles Basin into sub-basins, including this side somewhere out here. Shandon would be essentially a separate sub-basin from the Estrella area. And I honestly thought Creston was essentially a hydrogeologic distinct subbasin from Australia, and we worked to try and prove my preconceived notion, and we couldn't. It is just not there, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the Estrella area has far greater transmissivities. You can pump more water out of it. You can, not only for that reason, but also because there's just more stress there. That's why we see the groundwater depressions or lowering of groundwater levels there. But I tell you, the reason that we're starting to see water levels go down in the Creston area and out here too is not only because there's greater demands over overlying areas, but because there's we have those stresses in the Australian area, and water levels are flowing that direction. We're seeing degradation of water quality, that we wouldn't see otherwise, and that's because water levels are going down, and we're seeing different recharge mechanisms than we've seen in the past because of a water level depression in this Estrella area. You know, in my mind, there's just no question that there's a hydraulic communication, intercommunication there. It's slow. I mean, we're talking single digit feet per year flow. We're not talking rivers.
Right.
So, you know, it
we're like Shandon, like I say, towards the south. There's some real quick movement underground.
Well, there is in the underflow, in the alluvial system.
Oh, yeah, I think even beyond that.
I mean, that's very quick. You know, we're talking, you know, tens of feet per year flow there. But, you know, we do see the water quality differences. You know, the water quality coming in from the Schlamm area is terrible. You know, that we're pumping wells in the Shandon area that with total Zell solids of 400 milligrams per liter, 300, 400, 500 in that range. And we're getting surface flows coming out of Shalam at 2100. The eastern upper reaches of the San Juan Creek, some of those wells out there are 2000, 2500 milligrams per liter water quality in the basin. But it, you know, it's coming out of that. Out of the granites and the metamorphics on the southeast side of the basin, coming down through Shell Creek and
none of the bad stuff comes from Shell Creek.
No, that's real good quality water coming down through there.
We better wrap it up. Did you have one last question?
Yeah, I don't know. It's the last question, but you may have asked the question based on the slow movement of water. But if I'm assuming that the basin has a leak into Monterey County, and apparently fairly slow. If you were to add water in the basin somewhere in, let's say, Shandon, just for purpose of discussion, would that change the rate of outflow at some point?
No. And just because this basin is so huge, and the distance from here to the outlet is so great, and there is so much available storage between here and there that it would not change. It would not change the overall basin dynamics.
So it's overdrafted to the extent that there's a lot of capacity available. Pumped to the extent that there's a lot of
there. Yeah, pumped.
Yeah,
not overdrafted.
Pumped to the extent that there is available storage capacity in places. In places, there's not. You know, it wasn't very long ago that we saw historically high water levels in the Creston area. There is no storage there. We have Lake Creston, you know, not very long ago, was as big as it's ever been. But you know, there are places where there's available storage.
The other thing, too, is that the relative to response, where you would experience a rapid drawdown in your production well, is not where you would want to put a recharge. If that's the case, then you don't have any capacity there to recharge. You don't have any storage there.
If I could just make one comment on this gentleman's comment about, you know, my pump suck air.
Right.
I think it comes back to a slide that Courtney showed earlier. Got to be a yes deal, and it's part of one, the technical feasibility and evaluation, and you've identified, I think, probably the, in my view, the one of the top things that priority wise it needs to be looked at, and that's simply the aquifer response to additional recharge and recovery, i.e. what's the water level response of superimposed recharge under some scenario or scenarios, and the same on the recovery. And then finally, contractually, there have to be some protections. So anyway, I just wanted to add that.
And we're going to continue to have these meetings. In the back, you'll find a list of topic discussions. And I think our next goal is to meet with the Shannon Advisory Committee, line up with their Wednesday night meetings. And
we just had a question, and I don't know if they'll get up here very often. That's a long way. Do you have time for
just a real quick statement. I don't know if everybody knows, Cliff Trotter was the general manager at Arvin Edison Water Storage District. Water Storage District. And he has published, and I have, if you haven't seen it, their summary of their program over the last 30 years. It's also a good resource. Anybody wants it, I'd be happy to forward it to them.
Is he living in the Napomo area now?
He's one of my board of directors.
Yep. Even better.
Yep, you bet.
And Bruce is with the Napomo Community Services District, for those of you who didn't know. No longer the Los Osos Community Services
District. You said a dirty word.
Anyway, thanks for coming, and again, visit our website. I've got a comment form back there you can mail in to me, and we just want to keep working together towards our goals.
Okay. So you figured out you're like,
yeah.
I know that sounds like a familiar theme.
Yeah.
I guess in my company, we're highly involved in the valley, working that basic work, so it's like.
Oh, eat food! Take food with you!
I'm gonna get some cookies.
Yeah, I'm hungry too. I'm starting to pass out. I don't know. I've never met him. So I was bummed I didn't do introductions. I kind of forgot. Which one is the one in the hat?
No, the gray hair. Black coat.
Oh, yeah, I'm not really sure.